This is an MP3 audio clip from the weekly People First radio broadcast.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
While bullying is both wrong and hurtful, it happens every day in schools, malls, on the internet, and cell phones across Canada. One in five Canadian youth report being bullied regularly. Children and youth who are bullied are directly affected, but those who bully others and those who know what is going on are also affected. We're joined on the phone by Sybilla Arts, a professor in child and youth care at University of Victoria. Welcome to People First Radio.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Arts, give us a bird's eye picture of the bullying problem as it exists and what you have seen and observed in Canadian society today. Is bullying becoming a greater problem in schools and in communities at large?
No, it's not a greater problem. It's a problem that is ever present and has been. And I've several times surveyed adults from multiple generations and often also surveyed the parents of the students that have participated in the studies that I've conducted with my colleague, Ted Reakin. And we have learned during those surveys that everyone can remember the bully in their school. It doesn't matter what age they were. Many people can remember the people who bullied them by name. And again, there are no age barriers here. There are no generational barriers. This seems to be an ever-present problem. And in some ways, what has disturbed me over the years is that there seems to be a kind of basic acceptance that somewhere, somehow, this just is, and this is part of growing up. Another piece that I'm quite bothered by is that we speak about bullying as if this were a child and youth phenomena. In other words, it's something that children and adolescents do, when in fact there is a very, very important literature about this very same behavior in the workplace, in families, and we need only look around the world to see major bullying in action in many of the war zones that we hear about on our nightly news.
Now, a Canadian Psychological Association policy statement on bullying says that bullying is a problem in relationships in which power is used to cause distress to another, and it may be physical, verbal, nonverbal, or social, and may include racial, religious, homophobic, or gender-based harassment. Tell us more about how bullying behavior is defined and understood.
Well, the definition that you just read out is an excellent definition, a very commonly accepted one. I have on occasion written about this as our having to acknowledge that bullying is really the abuse of power. It's the transformation of power into domination and coercion, and that it is deliberate cruelty in action. And when I speak to the young people that I have worked with over the years and we talk about bullying as the exercise of cruelty, they get quite startled and they say, well, I don't want to be cruel. I'm just bullying. I'm really only doing this for fun. But then when we unpack it and we notice what pain it causes and that it is a cruel way to deal with people, that it is inflicting pain and that it is knowingly causing distress, they reevaluate whether they want to define themselves as people who do these kinds of things.
Now, I wanted to ask you if bullying was an extension of the behaviors we sometimes or even often see in politics, sports, workplaces, and even in religions. You've mentioned war zones earlier. Tell us more about the external environments where we observe and see bullying every day.
Well, just anywhere where you see an abuse of power, where power is used in ways that are deliberately designed to disadvantage someone purposefully in order to gain something from them, even if it's just an invitation to a party. If I use my personal ability to negotiate, to speak, to give voice to what I want, to in order to hurt someone or to disadvantage them or to put myself in front of them, because that will give me some sort of social social advantage, or in any other kind of way, an unfair competitive advantage that doesn't come out of my facing off with an equal, say as in a hockey face-off where we're going to see who gets the puck. We're both able to get the puck. I get the puck, you don't. It's a fair contest. When we turn that into an unfair contest where someone clips me from behind so that I can't get the puck and the other guy can, we are now abusing the power, the rules, and the dynamics of our human negotiated way of doing business. So you ask, give an example, some of the clearly abhorrent examples that have recently emerged in sports, in hockey in particular, about smashing people's heads against the boards, clipping them from behind, going for the face, these kinds of things. That's no longer sport. That's no longer the game. So this appears anywhere. If I'm in my workplace and I use my role as a faculty member to approach one of our admin support staff and do that in a condescending, rude, and nasty way, I'm no longer in a useful working relationship with this person. I am now abusing my role and my power in order to create discomfort, put someone down, to get what I want. That's bullying. And it's also cruel and painful for the person who's on the receiving end.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Kevin. I'm joined on the phone by Dr. Sybilla Arts, a professor in child and youth care at University of Victoria. We're talking about bullying, its causes, effects, and prevention. Dr. Arts, tell us more about the three parties involved in bullying: those who bully, those who are victimized, and those who witness bullying.
Well, those who bully, in other words, and let me use the term exercise cruelty against others and exercise domination and abuse their power, do so because they want something and they want it for themselves. But in many cases, the ones that I have interviewed and spoken with have had that experience that it's been done to them first. And so they realize that there's a certain ability to avoid being hurt themselves if they're the ones who were sort of first out there doing it. And they take up this stance in some ways to prevent it ever happening to them again. Others do it because they realize that there's a very big payoff if they are the most dominant person in the room and they can keep everybody else at bay by frightening them. The victim is often a lovely, decent person who may not be necessarily very extroverted, or might have interests that are not general interests, or may like to dress a little bit differently from other people. In other words, shows up as not following the demands of the dominant group, and therefore it becomes vulnerable. They're often extremely sensitive and lovely people who never have a chance to let that emerge because they need to do whatever they can to protect themselves. The bystanders, I think, very often size up the situation very well and realize that if they do or say anything, they might be next, which is one of the main reasons why bystanders who actually suffer from witnessing this don't act. They often are trying in some ways to protect themselves and prevent themselves from being the next victim. So, or indeed, some people choose to line up with the bully or get behind the bully. That way they're not in front of them. People don't necessarily like engaging in conflict and are not often very skilled at doing that, and so they refrain from doing so. But they do recognize the cost of what's going on.
Dr. Arts, you conducted a study in 1998 looking at violent schoolgirls. Mm-hmm. You concluded that two of the central patterns emerging which prepare them for involvement in violence are their extensive personal experience mm-hmm. with emotional, physical, sexual abuse,
yes.
and internalized notions of being female that assign low general worth to women. Now, you touched on this a little bit earlier. I'm mm-hmm. wondering if you could tell us more about it.
Sure. I mean, what you've done is a very lovely summary. Thank you very much. And I repeated very many parts of that study again in 2004, 2005, and found the same thing. We are vulnerable when we are made to feel less than others. It was very interesting for me to discover that girls who use aggression very often, of course, as you pointed out, have been subjected to aggression to begin with. And in their world, it becomes a way of surviving. The other thing is that they had a sort of misogynistic or unfriendly to females view of the world that fit with what they had been told about the value of women. And so they saw men as more important and more valuable than women, and they thought that if they had a boyfriend, and especially if they had a dominant and powerful boyfriend, that would give them a better sense of value, importance, and also safety. And so they saw the other girls who might be competition for this boyfriend as the people who could keep them from attaining that sense of value that they were hoping to attain by being seen to be allied with and cared for by these dominant males. And so they actively competed for the male gaze with other girls very similar to themselves. Of course, it never worked very well for very long, because especially at that age, we're learning about relationships, and we don't necessarily stay in long-term, lifelong committed relationships at the age of 14, 15. And so this was a continuous cycle of competition for the male gaze. Those girls who had a stronger sense of feminine worth, of being valued as women, who had other purposes in life perhaps than attracting this sort of kingpin boyfriend, did much better. They liked other girls better. They liked themselves as young women better. They saw more options and possibilities in their lives. And they also had better friendships and better relationships. So this idea of of helping people to see themselves as valuable outside their gender stereotypical scripts showed up as being really important towards violence prevention and intervention.
Dr. Sybilla Arts, we have just a moment left in our discussion today. I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to add.
I think that we need to understand that young people, just like adults, do need to have an experience where they feel that they're competent and capable and they have some power. But we need to make space for them to do this and model it for them to do this in a really positive and collaborative and enriching way, rather than to show them that the way to power is to put down other people. There's quite a lot of models around that suggest that the way to power is through dominance. There are even better models around that show that we can achieve collective positive power through collaboration, and that's where I think the emphasis needs to go.
Thank you very much for taking the time to join us today. I really appreciated it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for asking me.
All right. Bye-bye. Dr. Sybilla Arts is a professor in child and youth care at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Her research focuses on aggression, violence and family homelessness, and girls' use of violence.
People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Centrist Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society's CHLY 101.7 FM, chly.ca, community radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of these organizations.